So, discovering Columbus. Only in New York, as they say. Except, of course, this is a venture that the artist is responsible for in any number of cities now. Phoebe Hoban. Phoebe. If nothing else, we get to see a sculpture in a greater intimacy than we will ever have seen it before, having passed 59th Street and 8th Avenue any number of times in our lives. Indeed, the ascent up those stairs was an opportunity to savor the actual carved reliefs and ornaments on the column, which one would never have otherwise have seen. What kind of experience did you have once you reached the room?
Well, I thought it was definitely a New York experience. As a city that has fallen madly in love with the High Line, I love the fact that it's that it was elevated and it gave you different views of the city. So it was both an interior and exterior space. And I love the fact that it was such a sort of banal living room, but it had all these very personal touches. The PowerPoint is gone, but the wallpaper was quite unique. It was a pinkish color, kind of strange, with a light green pattern of Empire State Buildings, Elvis Presley's, and Mickey Mouse's. And that was clearly the artist's sort of reference to American iconography. And he actually designed the wallpaper himself. If you looked carefully at the bookcase almost exclusively held volumes about New York history, architecture, and culture, ranging from baseball to the opera. And every day they would replace the magazines and newspapers, so there was a Financial Times, a New York Times, you know, on the coffee tables.
Yes.
And they had a flat screen TV permanently tuned to CNN. And that was partly because the artists liked the contrast of the very current with the sort of antique of the sculpture of Columbus discovering America. I think one of the things that's amazing about New York, which is a cliche, is that when you walk around it, you're constantly noticing new architectural things that you've never seen before. And I can't say that I have ever in my life looked at the statue of Columbus before. I mean, Columbus Circle is a destination, but when do you ever look at it? And last but not least, the scale was a very nice kind of joke, which was that, you know, here you have this enormous Columbus that dwarfs everything in the living room, but the living room was normal human scale. So I thought it was a really wonderful example of public art that was also an installation piece, and it was interactive in the sense that you could walk through it and look out of it and look into it, and it was relatively self-explanatory and unpretentious, so I thought it was quite a successful project.
Right. So, Nora, it's public art about public art that takes as its central conceit privacy. I mean, you for the few moments, you know, for the quarter of an hour that you can spend up there, you have your own living room with an unusual sculptural presence within it, but with rather spectacular views. You can't order a coffee, unfortunately, but is it just a kind of quirky, fun, light New York experience, or is there something of profundity in this work?
Well, I approached it thinking that there'd be some kind of implicit critique of Columbus as a historical figure or of kind of colonialism in general, not really knowing too much about the artist or about the work. So I was quite surprised when I climbed the steps and actually came into the room and was kind of shocked by the gentleness of it and just the all-around pleasantness of being in a light-filled room. And I was also struck by how people rushed to take their photograph in front of the statue, almost as if the statue was a personification of Columbus as a celebrity. And also just so it goes back to the way that we now experience any kind of art event. We have to take an image of ourselves within the event. There were very few people that were just sitting. I was probably the only person that was kind of looking around without imaging myself within the installation. So I found that was quite interesting.
Did you find that you were really primarily engaging with with the sculpture and the installation, or was it actually the strange kind of social mechanics of the event, of one becomes a witness to one's fellow witnesses, doesn't one? And it's kind of difficult to have maybe the same experience that one would have if it was just an installation where there's only two or three people at a time wandering through, and it's no big deal to get to it.
Yeah, it seems to be a lot about being with their fellow New Yorkers, a lot of whom I felt were tourists too. Mm-hmm. And I waited online for a half hour. That was kind of part of the piece for me. It was the process of waiting, which was a little unpleasant. But mm-hmm. then you kind of are rewarded once you mm-hmm. enter the space. But I did take in the interior decoration. It felt very mid-century modern to me. There are prints of de Kooning on the wall, and the wallpaper with Elvis and Marilyn Monroe, and almost like a generic 40s, 50s decor. And I wondered what it would be like if the installation that the decor had been maybe overblown tacky or just more contemporary in a way, because it just read as very stylish New York and not really about America at all, I felt.
Or even if it just had just been Tatsu Nishi's actual living room, wherever that is permanently stationed. Don, the very experience of, though, a legendary, quasi-legendary 19th century sculpture overblown and oversized in a highly improbable context is actually a kind of juxtaposition that's probably very familiar to anybody used to, say, Max Ernst, Une Semaine de Bonté, or the Sontet. I wonder, was this project really doing something audacious? Is it somewhat treading water within a sort of Dada, institutionalized, you could say, Dada gesture?
Well, I think connecting it to Max Ernst is giving it more credit than it's due. I think the way to grab a hold of it myself is to revive Clement Greenberg's idea of novelty art. It's a version of conceptual art, basically, if you think conceptual art is art. I would myself call it pizza art and what it does to Italy there. But I think the main point of it is it's really designed as a tourist attraction. Columbus Circle is a central kind of little center in New York. A lot of buses go through there. A lot of subways of different lines go through there. Broadway is broken there. You're about a half a dozen blocks from Lincoln Center. People will go there. There's the entrance to Central Park there. Now, that's part of it. I think also what he's done is cut Columbus down to size, taken this gigantic mm-hmm. statue, whether you can see it up there or not, and you can see it from the Time Warner building if you go inside, mm-hmm. clearly, and put it in a living room, make it a piece of kitsch, as it mm-hmm. were, mm-hmm. Commonplace. And I thought the whole thing was very trendy, and its idea that all works are, so to say, equal, which mm-hmm. means none of them are quite valuable, so you put a de Kooning there with
yes.
some comic strip or whatever, and it's a very sort of quote, quasi postmodern, or what used to be called one of the definitions of postmodern stance. I thought it was amusing, basically, and it did what I think Bloomberg wants to do, is add to the 50 million tourists who come here and give them something else to give them a small thrill. Beyond that, I thought it was essentially a banal thing, but it did signal something else. It's a Japanese artist dealing with a monument to an Italian. In a signaling that in a living room context where there's all kinds of art. So it signals that basically New York is a kind of international city. I think that's mm-hmm. that's part of the notion of it. Mm. It may also signal an Asiatic takeover of New York, or at mm-hmm. least the United States. I think that is something in everybody's mind, although Japan is not China. I thought the work was basically overblown, clever, sort of clever kind of thing, and very attention-grabbing just simply by its location. It had to be attention-grabbing, and its novelty drew people. It was something else to see. okay. In New York.
Yes, right. Tourist attraction, a little bit of Disney da-da. So, Phoebe, do you buy Don's take there? Or is that a little
harsh? Well, I would agree with him. I mean, I pronounce banal, banal, and I've never... I don't know which is the correct pronunciation, but
you're
I do think...
Correct.
No, I've heard it both ways, and I do... I would say that the artwork was banal, whether deliberately or not, and I don't consider it by any means high art or even low art. I mean, I think it's very commercial art, and I think it's meant to be a tourist attraction, so I don't think... I wouldn't elevate it in my mind to, like, great conceptual art or installation art. I mean, yes, it had... Disney Dada is a great term for it. I mean, it does have a reference to surrealism because of the scale, because of the combination of elements in it. But, I mean, it's sort of almost too trivial to criticize. I mean, it's not... I wouldn't... It's not an artwork that I would write a review of, for instance, because I don't think of it as something that's attempting... as such to be art. It's attempting to be sort of a project, and as a project it succeeds as far as I can tell. It's attracting tourists, it's giving New Yorkers a different view of the city and of the sculpture, and it's fun. Mm. There's nothing wrong with going and looking at art that's fun occasionally.
That's true. I went hoping to either be like Rilke with his poem to the the torso of Apollo. You know, I wanted the sculpture either to say change your life, or I wanted to have a profoundly indignant experience and be able to rant about public
art. No, the point of it is to keep
art.
Your life the same.
And you say it did seem to say keep your life the same, and New York is fun, and lighten up. There's this is just a New York experience rather than an aesthetic experience. In a funny way though, banal, however one wants to say it, it's got a lot of that going on, and yet. Maybe actually part of its banality, Nora, is that it presses all the right buttons to be the opposite, to actually be profound and political and to be about the big dichotomies, public and private, contemporary and historic, blah, blah, blah. In other words, it's as if a pre-printed form on how to make profoundly important public art, and the artists have checked every box. And yet somehow it didn't really add up to anything more than fun. Did I miss something?
Well, it felt so restrained. There was so much that it could have been. There could have been, if it was just a white cube around the statue, or if it was a completely different room, it could have been a work of art that actually made something happen. The fact that it was still kind of contributed to it being just... you know, a kind of throwaway fun. I mean, I didn't really find it fun, actually. But I think there's a little bit of a problem when you make art about a city landmark. I didn't see the gates. I don't think I was I was here that year.
Don't
but,
worry.
It's kind of like gilding the lily in a way. If you're making something already about a work of the city, already to me is a work of art. And its sculptures, its monuments, its buildings, to kind of put art on top of that, populist art on top of that, I think there's going to be problems there. They could be very interesting problems, but I think with the Columbus statue, the problems weren't that interesting.
Yes, it's sort of icing on, slightly saccharine icing on an already very tasty cake. Yes, okay, well...
I thought it was sort of Hollywood set waiting for the actors, and the people who visited were the actors.
Yes.
And it was more amusing to watch the people than...
Well, that's tends
very
to be,
surface.
Yeah.
Very
like,
surface.
I think what Nora said about, it didn't... Obviously, Columbus is a great example of colonialism, and if Columbus had been surrounded by diagrams of syphilis and how it, pretty much destroyed part of the Native American population, then it would have been a political piece of art. I mean, he deliberately stayed away from anything political, and I just wanted to contrast it to another piece of installation art that isn't public, but it was up concurrently, which was Thomas Hirshhorn's Concordia, Concordia, at the Barbara Gladstone Gallery, which I watched it being made, and I do think that managed to have an effect that this does not, because it, while not delving deeply into the politics of, of cruise ships and of greed and of really bad kitsch culture and of the irresponsibility of the cruise ship line when it came to the safety of its passengers, it nonetheless did evoke all of that. And it evoked it, I thought, in a much more imaginative and artistic way. I mean, I would call that art. You might not like it. You might think it was too in your face. You might think it didn't actually create the real situation in the Concordia or didn't go into any of them in enough depth. But it was something that you could sink your teeth into. And
right.
This is just a treehouse. You know, it's a really cool treehouse, in my opinion.
Don't you think the Hirsch one was sort of a version of Damien Hirst in some way, sort of the pile of junk in the studio that he's exhibited sometime? And don't you think it's very easy to be, quote, politically evocative? It's almost cliches to be critical now of whatever you want to be critical of. And don't you think it's just sort of not only hers, but a leftover kind of three-dimensional collaging, a very old idea, some getting its sensation. And it's the evocation and the imagery which seems to me makes the whole thing count, and sort of the theory behind it. It's sort of theory-driven art that makes it count more than the installation itself.
I think there's a danger there, Dom. There's a show that not all of us saw, and Phoebe's
ways
of bring it up as a contrast, but rather in scale rather than necessarily an intensity and engagement. But those points are totally valid, definitely, in relation to...
I just want to say something. All of this is a version of what Alan Kaprow called post-art many, many years ago. He talked about the education of the unartist. And he pointed out that the, what has been called now cliched, the breakdown of the boundaries between art and life. And I always like to add at the expense of both. You know, that's my own thought. But
right.
Kaprow famously said, you know, that there is no art that could compete with a rocket to the moon, or the best architecture was these gas stations on the highway with a few stilts and
yeah.
cover and so forth. And he thought finally there was no point to art, which is quite interesting since he began as an expressionist painter, as you may know, and he essentially just went into installations and
you say just went into installations? I mean as in exclusively or as in as a diminution of his ambition?
No, I was not talking about Johns.
I know it's about Keenholz, yes?
Yeah, no, I'm talking about Kaprow.
Kaprow's
ideas.
Oh, Kaprow, right.
And I think Kaprow reached a sort of very significant point, which I happen to know about. Many years ago at the University of Barcelona, he was invited very reluctantly, accepted. It was by a critic in a Barcelona newspaper. And he was asked what he would do, and he said he didn't know until he got there. So when he got there, what he did is he asked all the students and anybody else who wanted to mop the floors for 3 days of the art building that was there. And then we would sit and analyze it. So you can do that, okay? And the question I ask is, why do you want to call it art? Why do you even want to append the idea of art to this activity?
Right.
What are we talking about anymore? You know, it's sort of like what has been called the anything goes idea now.
Yes. I mean, these are the perennial issues, and one should never skirt the big issues and use the excuse of having three more shows to look at to curtail a philosophically interesting debate. But my job is to be boring and banal and anal. So let's now look at Michelle Stewart. And Don, let me start with you. Let me say to you, this is a show, let me confide in you, this is a show that almost like the last show had one thing in common. I mean, it had many things not in common. It couldn't have been a more kind of restrained, scholarly, private sort of experience compared to the funfair aspect of discovering Columbus. But the one thing it had in common is that I came in not knowing whether I to love it or hate it. I felt that it was it had many virtues to it, but I sort of came out each time I saw it, came out thinking, my God, I got to sit down in public in front of an audience of people and have a strong opinion on Michelle Stewart, who's considered a distinguished veteran. And yet, the only thing I can go away with thinking, apart from really liking many of the individual images that she's gathered, is thinking, is it possible to put diverse images into a grid without it looking like a school geography project? the grid is. I mean, you've talked many times about how institutionalized Dada is like the curse of our times. Rosalind E. Krauss has written a brilliant seminal essay on the grid. I wonder if somebody could now put the two together, a sort of Kraussian, Cuspidian analysis, and say maybe it's the grid that's one of our curses.
Yes. Rudolf Arnheim argued in his book Entropy and Art that the grid was a, so to say, symbol of and a way of homogenizing art, and it was a symbol of leveling of all the images. And as you know, for example, Richter used the grid in the first work, one of the first works that made him famous in the Cologne and Ludwig Museum now, with the images of all these different people, all well known from different areas, taken from encyclopedias, and he just put them up and they're all the same, they're all leveled. Part of what he called, he's doing nothing, it's one way to interpret this, nihilistic, okay? Like the album, you know, 50 images of sunsets, 50 images of girls, 50 images of this, that, and the other thing. So for me, the difference is the following, and I sort of approached it in a different way, perhaps because I've known Michelle for a long time, so I may be prejudiced in her favor. But I saw, first, I didn't quite buy the palimpsest title. I think I know what a palimpsest is. I thought these were sort of photo manipulations. But what I saw was a certain kind of aesthetic subtlety in individual images, a kind of very interesting nuancing that was occurring. The images were nuanced. There were, in some of them, some very interesting, let's say, light-dark relations. She was, I think, delving into the history of photography to some extent in some of the works as well. She was signaling a past, and she was signaling also her own past to some extent and her own environment. So while the work had her world, as it were, and in that sense was very much, you know, the modern artist concerned with the self, if you want to call it narcissism, but there was also some other things going on there which gave the work some kind of, shall we say, expansive meaning beyond her own, referencing her own existence or things from her own life or places she's been, etc. So that's the thing. Now, the grid idea is what I think she was trying to do. It's hard to, it was like a scrapbook in some sense. It was like laying out a scrapbook. And it was a little too neat, okay? So if you read a row across, each sort of neutralized the other. That's not exactly the right word, neutralized, but somehow it didn't give each its full due.
Right, but hopefully the sum is greater than the individual parts.
I was not certain of that. I felt the individual parts counted for more than the sum, and I was not always certain what the sum was. I was not always certain what it added up to, whether it added up to a, an integral whole. There was some, so to say, quote, secret meaning implicitly connected, an underground unconscious meaning that was connected to them. In certain instances, I think I got it, particularly in the, quote, nature references work. In the personal references work, I thought I got it to some extent as well. But it was not clear. But it did have this incoherence in a curious way, which is, quote, very modern as well. And I think
a sort of provisional quality.
Provisional quality, if you want to call it that, yes. I think she did a good job at that.
Good job at being provisional, yes.
Provisional and suggestive. Suggestive.
Provisional, suggestive. But, Nora, when I say, when I complain about the grid, let me be clear about one thing to save my reputation, what little remains of my reputation as somebody who can speak with any coherence on modern art, which is to say that when the grid is serial, and when the grid is working with some degree of genericness or repetition, that's when I think it derives its particular potency and charge. I love the Beckers, and I love Sean Scully. Now, those are two very extremely different artists, but they're both they both energize, they both utilize the grid, but understanding that that it's that the matrix works when the contents have some very sort of nuanced differentiation. Do you think the grid works to Stuart's favor?
Well, I don't really see it as a grid. I saw it more as a storyboard, because also the individual pieces There was different spaces between them in different works. So it wasn't like there was one uniform grid she was following. And there was a kind of a sense of experimentation, almost like a lab experiment. And I saw the work almost like as if they were specimens and kind of behind glass. I think the way they were framed is really important, too. I was trying to figure out how that was done, actually. It looks like they're almost as if they're like a butterfly. The photographs are kind of pressed with a glass right in front of it, and then there's like a black metal around it, too, that seems kind of casual, but also very thought out, too. I thought it was really interesting how it really, for me, restored mystery to photography.
Right.
And to me, it's kind of about the emergence of a viewing public in America in the turn of the century, in the 19th century, and about how violence and entertainment are so closely linked. A lot of the photographs, I think she created a lot of them. They're manipulated, but they look like they're found photographs.
Yes, that's a curiosity about them, isn't it?
Yeah.
They're found, but they are made, but they look found. They have a period feel to them. Phoebe, did you find a very distinct, pervasive mood? Were there stories that generating in your mind as a result of these images? How did it work for you?
Well, I don't know if I want to really answer that question head on, but
okay.
Just to go back to the grid for a moment. I agree with Nora. I mean, I agree with you. I think the grid is useful when it generates tension because the content is sort of almost the opposite of the formality of a grid, and the artists that have most succeeded with using a grid are almost working against the grid. But I didn't find the grid superimposed on this. To me, these were like two-dimensional Cornell boxes. They're very lyrical. They're very evocative. The individual images are quite beautiful and haunting. I would say they suffer from their multiplicity. I felt overwhelmed. I mean, knowing that, especially that I would have to be able to say something about it, confronted with a grouping which is meant to be almost, interestingly, Leslie Tokunow told me that, I mean, each one of these grids, if you want to call it that, or storyboards, is considered one piece.
Right, sure.
And considering that one piece contains in it 60 tiny squares, like a crossword puzzle, I found it a bit overwhelming to try to take in that many images. That said, I didn't really think they were provisional in the sense that each piece, and I think there were 8 of them or something, had a theme. I mean, one was death, one was war, one seemed to be sort of ephemera, you know, the ephemera of beauty and nature, like feathers and butterflies and so on. So they were thematic, but to me, it was difficult to digest that many images at one time, and I found it, I wouldn't say annoying so much as kind of overwhelming, and in that sense, even though the images played off each other, I would agree with Donald in that they didn't build to a climax. In some cases, they almost took away from each other because there were just too many of them.
Yeah, I felt if I could have seen less of them, but at a bigger scale, and as individual images to be relished and in a row around the gallery, that would have encouraged me to make my own grids or my own matrices, which would have, I feel, been probably more satisfying. And funnily enough, I, as somebody who loves still images and is a slow adapter to video, this is a body of material that almost feels like it would have been better as a slideshow or in a sort of either a Kara Walker or a Nan Goldin type structure where one could actually have the element of time rather than space as the filler between images.
Isn't part of the point of the grid that the collective counts more than the individual?
Absolutely.
So the individual piece gets lost there. Isn't also a grid a sort of standard, even stereotype, modern device? There is no priority given to any image. There's a kind of quasi-universality suggested, if not confirmed, by the grid. I agree with you completely that if each element in the grid was the same module, as it were, it might have a different effect. But then that would be the monotone, the monotonous kind of thing that has been talked about.
Completely identical, then it's just monotony. If it's startlingly contrastive, mm-hmm. then it's just a cliched format. Mm-hmm. But there's a middle ground where one has the same genus but distinct variants, and that's what you get in, say, the Beckers, for instance. Yeah. And it's what you get in, I think. But sometimes it's what you get in.
But they're not such
John,
big
sometimes
grids.
Not.
They're not such
right.
huge grids.
Exactly.
I wonder if she was in some way trying to bombard us to give us a variety of sensations sort of quickly, and that would confirm, support your idea that maybe this should have been a slideshow. It might have had, and time as the dimension.
Yeah.
That I think would have made it in a way more interesting.
Because when you look at a Becker, it's usually 3x3.
Right.
And when you look at it, it has a singular gestalt
exactly.
because of that, because it's few enough. When you look at a Scully or a Johns or a Marden, when they use the grid, again, there is the gestalt that the grid generates. But when you've got a huge grid or storyboard, whichever you want, if it doesn't have a single gestalt and you have to read it left to right, then it's a storyboard, not a grid, I think one could almost say.
I think she was trying to arrange her memory traces and to find some kind of grouping of memories or memorable
right.
experiences or give you some memorable experience. But after all, photography is time-bound. Mm-hmm. It involves memory. She's manipulating it in some way. Some pieces seem to quote, like lived experience memory, others mm-hmm. not so lived experience. So there is a kind of recollective mentality going on here, and partly recollecting her own career as well, and her own insularity in her personal space, her studio, her collection of things which have become associated with her and somehow signal her existence. So I thought that was extremely interesting psychologically, so to say.
Right. The periodness, then. Let's just confront that, because it is very interesting that they have such a found feel to them. However, I don't know her biography intimately. I know she's a senior figure within the art community, but she's definitely not old enough for these to be memories. These are late 19th century images, often, or else they're Zeppelins crashing and things. That's a very time specific kind of image. Do you think, is there a little bit of a sort of history play going on here? It almost felt like it was a photographic equivalent of sort of Neo Rausch or something, that there was a sort of a play on periodicity here.
Suppose she's signaling that there's nothing new in some sense, and that photography has come into its own as an art, and maybe it always was an art.
Well,
aren't these all photographs of photographs? I mean, they're manipulated. They're photographs
sure.
of photographs, so they're already two steps removed from the subject.
But it intensifies the whole thing.
I thought the most successful one, actually, was the one that it was a slightly larger format square, so each module was bigger, and it was almost abstract, the one of the lenses.
Yeah.
You know, that one stood as a work of art on its own, where as a grid, you could stand back from it and find some beauty in it, whereas the others, I was constantly forced to look at individual images within it. I really could not take them in as a whole. In terms of the periodicity, I mean, I do think she's she's making a comment about photography and about how we record history and about how we record our lives. And, you know, I don't think it's necessarily very profound or original, but I think I like the notion of the photographs of photographs, and that these are images that mean something to her, and that's why she bothered to mm-hmm. bring them to our attention.
Mm-hmm.
They have a souvenir quality to them.
Yes.
Laura, any last thoughts on that? Yes.
It's interesting that we were talking so much about the grid and kind of the format of her work, because the individual images, to me, are about things that are so powerful that they're almost unspeakable. A lot of it is about death, I thought, death and war and kind of the banality of war, the kind of nothingness. There's a series of battle scenes that are... There are no bodies in them, but there's a kind of emanation that something has occurred here. And then there's a series that looks like kind of a cave painting. I'm not sure if she manipulated that or if they're I'm not sure where they're what the date is, but it's just this sense of before our time. This kind of there's another series of Zeppelins kind of in the cosmos, and there's that was very interesting to me. It was this kind of grafting of very specific like early modern era onto this like time in that could be in the extreme future.
Yes. Well, I think we'll all have probably a chance to say another word on both these shows in response to comments that we hear from the floor. So let's have our roving mic, please. And please, ladies and gentlemen, wait however much you feel you have a...
The two first.
No. We take some comments, because otherwise the audience loses track of everything we've been talking about. Right. So we take a little bit of comment, and then we do it again. However beautifully trained and operatic voice you feel you have, wait for the mic, because otherwise we won't be able to record you and might not be able to hear you. So let's do it one show at a time. Let's start with Tatsu Nishi, if we could, Discovering Columbus. Anybody have a legend to tell about their experience with this show? Any comment, any critique, any question on Columbus? Yes.
My niece, who's now in her mid-20s, came home from school long ago to say she'd learned about Thanksgiving, that today is the day the pilgrims came to wreck us. And I think that you won't find a child alive now who doesn't know that Columbus was part of a wave of colonialism, or that Columbus brought spirochetes, or that Columbus did all these negative things. But the thing that I enjoyed about Discovering Columbus was this faux naivete, this nostalgia, this sense of rediscovering Columbus as an idol, as a hero, as an iconic figure. It was really charming, and I think a lot of people got that. Maybe it takes a foreign-born artist to do that, but it's certainly against the trend of political correctness. And he was... Because the statue itself is not a great statue, it's kind of inexpressive, not terribly interesting. It really made a giant kitsch statuette out of it. But also, as with kitsch, there is sentiment, or it wouldn't be kitsch. There's mm-hmm. fondness, there's nostalgia, there's real sentiment underneath it, and I like that.
Yeah, I think that's a very fair point. It's not as if he was making fun of a Rodin or a Mayol or something. It is a piece of dated period art. So a statue, not a sculpture. So very good point. Yes. Anything more on Nishi? No. Okay. Well, let's say goodbye, Columbus, and let's get some stimulating comments from the from our audience tonight on Michelle Stewart. Must be bursting with things to say about Michelle Stewart, the grid, the period feel. Yes, gentleman in the front.
Hi, this question is for Mr. Cuspet. You said you were talking to Alan Capro, and you said, why did you make the students mop the floor and call it art? Did he give you an answer to that, or?
First, I was not talking to him. I was aware of this whole thing and so forth. But I do know this, that he's positioned himself as a guru, as it were, and a Zen kind of experience, supposedly. So if you mop the floor, there's something Zen-like in the focus of it. 3 days is a little over-focused to my mind, but that was the idea. And as he said, the whole point was to stimulate discussion of what does it mean to be in an art school, mopping the floor of an art school, what does it mean to be making something called art or studying something called art, how can you locate this piece, if you can locate it. So the whole point for him, if I understand correctly, was whatever thoughts or ideas or notions were generated by this event. And what was crucial for him is participation. It was the participation. So it's not exactly an installation, but it was a participation event. And if you look at the early happenings, which first took place in George Siegel, it was all about participation, performance, what this would mean, where it was located, out in a farm, not near any art center, not in an exhibition space, etc. So, you know, what happened to the halls when you mopped them? Also, you're identifying with the janitors. All this kind of social thing was what he was concerned with.
Yeah, the thing always that troubles one is when people, whether it's he's a Zen master or an art theorist, when they tell you to mop the floor for 3 days, my first question is, are you going to join us? Anyway, let's move on, if we can, to part two in the PowerPoint, please. Usually the people who have advice like mop the floor for 3 days wouldn't do it for 3 minutes themselves.
But it's so artistic.
Yes.
Gestural.
It is.
Paintbrush. All the associations you can do with this.
You can make a great Jasper Johns afterwards.
It could be a great performance piece.
It's a good segue to Louise Fishman. That's